Algerian relationship. To that end, the United States is now considering sanctioning Algeria for a $7 billion weapons deal with Moscow that was inked last year. Surely, it's purely coincidental that it's only now that Europe is increasingly showing up on Algeria's doorstep with flowers that these sanctions threats are suddenly materializing. Any country continuing to support Russia as it relates to the conflict in Ukraine right now, it's unjust and it's unlawful infringement on Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty would be deeply problematic, said U.S. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesman Vedant Patel. When asked to comment on a bipartisan letter demanding sanctions against Algerian government officials sent by members of Congress to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, any such sanctions wouldn't just hit Algeria. Wherever the EU's economic diversification away from United States dependence goes, sanctions seem to follow. Such was the case with Iran and the bloc's gas supply from Russia through the new Nord Stream 2 pipeline, for example. And it all comes at a time when some European leaders are starting to make noises suggesting the United States is taking advantage of the European Union's increased dependence on US natural gas in the wake of sanctioning its supply from Russia. Some countries, some of which are considered friends, partially charge astronomic prices. Germany's economy minister, Robert Habeck, said in an interview earlier this month. Robert Habeck added, "The United States approached us when oil prices were high, leading to a release of national oil reserves also in Europe. I think this kind of solidarity would also work well for lowering gas prices." Good luck with that begging as a strategy until the European Union stops letting Washington call the shots and meddle in its relationships. It's never going to be able to find true happiness and prosperity with Algeria or with anyone else.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The European Union has imposed sanctions on Iran over its response to recent riots in the country. The sanctions list includes 11 individuals and 4 entities and targets a section of Iran's police, the Basij Volunteer Forces, and the cyber division of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The Iranian Information Minister is also blacklisted. The coercive measures include travel bans and asset freezes. The sanctions were imposed during a meeting of EU foreign ministers. The move drew strong condemnation from Tehran, with the Iranian Foreign Ministry promising reciprocal bans on European officials and entities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran will make a reciprocal and proportionate reaction.
Iran's foreign ministry has described the EU sanctions as a violation of international law and a clear example of meddling in the country's internal affairs. The ministry also accused the bloc of bias and using human rights as a means to achieve political goals. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian also took to Twitter to dismiss the sanctions as futile and based on false allegations.
Down a well-worn path of ineffective sanctions, the EU today adopted further superfluous sanctions on Iranian persons. It is an unconstructive act out of miscalculation based on widespread disinformation. Riots and vandalism are not tolerated anywhere. Iran is no exception.
The EU and its member states had already acquired a reputation as major violators of human rights in Iran due to their inaction and endorsement of harsh US sanctions on the country. In the statement, the EU condemned what it called the widespread and disproportionate use of force against peaceful protesters in Iran. The EU foreign ministers accused the Iranian police of being responsible for Mahsa Amini's death, claiming she was beaten and mistreated. That's while a forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten and attributed her death to an underlying condition. The EU has intentionally disregarded and dismissed documents offered by Iran proving foreign support for the riots and showing that accusations leveled against the government are baseless. The US, Canada, and the UK leveled new sanctions against Iranian authorities and entities in response to the recent unrest in Iran, and the EU followed suit. These countries say Iranians' right to peacefully protest must be ensured under any circumstances. But as Iran's foreign minister has described it, these nations have considered riots and terrorist actions as protests in interventionist comments, which in effect incite rioters and terrorists.
We need to separate the riots from peaceful demonstration. Anyone in their right state of mind will understand the difference between these two and separate them. The reality is people do have legitimate right everywhere in the world. Indeed, in Iran is part of the Iranian constitution. They have the right to demonstrate, but no one has got the right to commit riots and endanger people's lives.
Meanwhile, there have been plenty of instances of the Western government's widespread violations of human rights and suppression of peaceful protests in their own countries, particularly in the EU. Serious human rights violations, including corruption, human trafficking, racism, and discrimination, persist across Europe, while unemployment and poverty in many countries are nurturing extremism and conflicts. Therefore, Iranian officials say the EU cannot impose sanctions on Iran as long as countries within the bloc are violating human rights.
Beijing's Great Hall of the People saw Xi Jinping, the Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, attempt to cement his power by setting out to clinch an unprecedented third five-year term as president. In his address to some 2,300 officials and delegates from across the country, he laid out his policies and lauded some of his government's achievements. Among those achievements, President Xi reiterated the validity of his harsh zero-COVID policies. Policies which, to this day, shut down major cities and operations in China sporadically and disrupt businesses in a world increasingly accepting of COVID-19 as a reality to live with. In fact, China's civil aviation predicts that by the end of next year, the country's air traffic, while double the current figures, will still be just 15% of what it used to be before COVID. The policy's toll on people's mental health, though, may have been the biggest cost of China's success in containing the virus. Repeated lockdowns has resulted in the Chinese youth developing gaming addictions, sleep abnormalities, and a reluctance to go outside. Of course, COVID wasn't the only thing President Xi discussed in his address. He called for accelerating the country's military development while China already spends the second largest military budget in the world after the US. The military plan aims to improve China's ballistic missile capabilities, develop various aircraft carriers, and establish overseas outposts. Xi can lay out such military development plans because he doesn't just hold the title of President of People's Republic of China or the title of Secretary General of the CCP. He is also Chairman of the Central Military Commission. Taiwan's relations with China as well as the US have been clearly defined in the One China policy. It is the diplomatic acknowledgement by the U.S. that there is only one Chinese government and that the U.S. can have no formal ties with the island of Taiwan, but rather with the Chinese government. The policy has a long history dating as far back as 1949 after the end of the Chinese Civil War, but it was in 1979 when, under Jimmy Carter's presidency, the U.S. finally established formal diplomatic ties with Beijing and thus severed ties with Taiwan and closed its embassy in Taipei. But in that very same year, the U.S. also passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which meant that it would support the island's ability to defend itself by supplying it with arms. The U.S. has always maintained strong informal ties with Taiwan. The One China policy was undermined much further during Trump's presidency, and not just because of former president's inflammatory remarks about China.
And then we had the horrible plague come in from China. Boy, oh boy, what they cost the world.
It was because after decades, Tsai Ing-wen, president of Taiwan, spoke to a U.S. president, breaking diplomatic protocol. Sino-U.S. relations have only gone downhill from there. The biggest offense in the eyes of China happened when U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island in August in a move that infuriated China. Since then, Beijing's resolve to reunify with Taiwan has only gotten stronger. Xi Jinping has time and again rejected any form of separatism, as well as interference in the island's affairs, as it considers Taiwan a part of its territory. Xi's call for accelerated military development could hint at his impatience over U.S. meddling and his increasing resolve over following through with his reunification plans with Taiwan.
We gather at a vital time for the United Kingdom. These are stormy days.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss may not have known what she walked into when she took over the premiership just months ago from the former Prime Minister Boris Johnson. An economy battered by COVID-19, then the Ukraine conflict, which impacted the UK's economy negatively. With runaway inflation and a cost of living crisis, she had to come up with a plan. That plan was presented by the finance minister, or exchequer at the time, Kwasi Kwarteng. But she could never have anticipated the firestorm and crisis that erupted afterwards. After several U-turns of whether or not she would go through with what was called a mini-budget plan, she was forced to finally make amendments to the plan. And what many have called a move to save herself and her job, she fired the now former finance minister, Kwasi Kwarteng.
I met the former chancellor earlier today. I was incredibly sorry to lose him.
She replaced him with Jeremy Hunt, a former health secretary and foreign secretary, who was announced as Kwarteng's successor.
It was a mistake to cut the top rate of tax at a period when we were asking everyone to make sacrifices. And it was a mistake to fly blind and not to back up the economic plans that were announced with an independent forecast from the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Truss scrapped the pledge to reverse predecessor Boris Johnson's hike of corporation tax from 19% to 25%, a decision estimated to restore around £18 billion, or $20.1 billion, to the UK Treasury's coffers by 2026. Her explanation for scrapping the plan, markets were not ready for it.
But it is clear that parts of our mini-budget went further and faster than markets were expecting. So the way we are delivering our mission right now has to change.
The Institute of Fiscal Studies had doubts on this so-called mini-budget, basically calling into question where the money was going to come from. It said that unfunded tax cuts meant that the UK will need £60 billion in spending cuts. It also said that this would leave ministers making serious reductions in public services. This puts into question claims made by the former Chancellor, Kwasi Kwarteng.
The government has been clear that protecting consumers is our primary focus and shapes our entire approach to this issue.
As for the 2.5% targeted growth, nonsense. said the UK will struggle to grow at more than 0.8% on average over the next 5 years. In other words, the £45 billion cost of the mini-budget would wipe out any financial space left to the Chancellor by his predecessor, swelling Britain's debt as the share of national income for at least the next 5 years. The turmoil that exists in the UK mirrors what is happening across many European countries. Economies are under strain and people are suffering as a result. Wrong fiscal policies can be the reason for this suffering, but political directives also impact people's lives and well-being. That couldn't be more evident on the EU, led by the US, to continue the war on Russia, even if it meant that their own citizens would suffer as a result. But cracks are emerging following the US lead. For example, France has joined Germany in accusing the US of using Ukraine war to overcharge for gas. After the Ukraine conflict, the EU was forced to start importing LNG from the US as well as other countries. But the US's share had increased sharply from 28 to 45%. On the other hand, deliveries from Russia dropped by 75%. But this statement from the French economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, shows that France may have caught on to the US role in the Ukraine conflict. Le Maire recently told French MPs that the conflict in Ukraine must not result in the US economic domination and a weakened Europe. This is while the economy minister, Robert Habeck from Germany, accused LNG exporters, including the US, of charging too much for gas at the time when Europe's biggest economy is struggling to balance its energy mix without Russian supplies, and when German companies are closing down factories due to high gas costs. Electricity cuts in the UK and emergency gas rationing in Germany are just a couple of signs of how European leaders are sacrificing their country in order to defeat Russia and the less threat that they face from it. As for their economies, Europe has already slipped into a recession, and there are no signs that it can devise a plan that would lower energy costs to pre-Ukraine conflict levels in order to save their economies.
Whether signed in the White House or overseen by a U.S. president or secretary of state, the United States has almost always had a role in any and all negotiations between Palestinian and Israeli sides. Looking at some of the more important instances of these talks, one can think of the first Oslo Accord in 1993 that was signed in Washington in the presence of then-U.S. President Bill Clinton. The 1999 Sharm el-Sheikh Memorandum that was signed in Egypt was also overseen by the U.S. through Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State of the Clinton administration. The unsuccessful Camp David summits in the year 2000 was overseen directly by Bill Clinton himself. Following the unsuccessful peace talks, Clinton would make another effort at influencing the Israeli-Palestinian relations through the aptly named Clinton parameters, showing the extent of his and U.S. involvement in the talks. Sometimes this influence even meant that the fate of Palestine would be discussed without the participation of any Palestinian representative, as was the case in the Camp David Agreement in 1978, which was signed by Egyptian President, Israeli Prime Minister, and then US President Jimmy Carter, without even an Arabic version of the documents. These showed the never-wavering U.S. Pledge of Allegiance to Israel, a pledge that will always protect Israeli interests, which would automatically go against Palestinian interests. Among the most important of these interests is a trinity of inalienable rights defined by the Palestine National Council in 1974, which consists of Palestinians' right to self-determination, an independent state, and most importantly, right of return. The most recent example of neglecting these rights occurred in 2020. During Trump's tenure, the deal of the century was presented, which many later called the flop of the century. The Trump peace plan was titled Peace to Prosperity, a vision to improve the lives of the Palestinian and Israeli people. But it was far from that. The plan had been delayed by 2 years and previously rejected by the Palestinians, who were not invited to the meeting. The plan never materialized, however, since, again, it was not representative of the Palestinians' rights on major core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The first time Israel attempted to make the smallest bit of compromise was at the Camp David summit in 2000. Israel said it would be willing to allow 100,000 Palestinian refugees back to their homeland, while the millions of others had to be resettled wherever they were at the time. Also, Yasser Arafat, then chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, would have to forego the idea of right of return completely from then on. Similar ludicrous proposals that were rejected by Arafat were all proposed with the US being on board with these proposals. The US involvement in the so-called peace talks have time and again shown Palestinians and their officials that the US is not to be trusted as a neutral party. On the sidelines of the sixth summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia in Kazakhstan, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas had a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. In it, he expressed that he is happy with Russia's position on Palestine. He also said that he would only accept U.S. involvement in the conflict resolution process if other parties of the Quartet on the Middle East were present. The Middle East Quartet, established in Madrid in 2002, is a foursome of nations and international and supranational entities involved in mediating the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. Its members are the United Nations, the United States, the European Union, and Russia. Palestine's hand is now one of unity, since the Palestinian factions have all established peace amongst themselves, including Hamas and Fatah. Palestinian factions signed reconciliation agreements in Algeria. Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year after the successful talks held in Algiers. Meanwhile, when it comes to peace talks between Israel and Palestine, Abbas has stressed that Washington should not be given free hand to act alone in resolving the decades-long Palestine-Israeli conflict.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. in the limelight.
Economic inflation is continuing in America and prices move faster than the increase in salaries of employees and workers in this country. Problems in the supply chain, the war in Ukraine and high demand for consumers have kept the prices of goods in the United States at the highest level in the past 40 years. In a report, CNN says inflation is rampant in the United States and the central bank's tool to fight price increases is to set higher interest rates. This makes borrowing more expensive and slows down the U.S. economy. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us for more. The New York Post writes, an analysis from the Heritage Foundation showed the average American has lost $4,200 in annual income since President Joe Biden took office. Experts at the conservative think tank said in a recent report the losses come down to surging inflation and higher interest rates. Their analysis found that the average American has lost about $3,000 in annual purchasing power because consumer prices, which have risen 12.7% since January of 2021, have spiked significantly faster than wages. Wages have risen just 8% over the same period, which has effectively resulted in a pay cut for Americans struggling to pay for daily necessities, including food, gas, and rent. Higher interest rates and borrowing costs have also reduced the average person's purchasing power by another $1,200. E.J. Anthony, a research fellow in regional economics with the Heritage Foundation's Center for Data Analysis, says, simply put, working Americans are $4,200 poorer today than when Joe Biden took office. He added, this financial catastrophe for American families is a direct result of a president and Congress addicted to spending our money, combined with a Federal Reserve compliantly enabling this addiction by printing more dollars. E.J. Anthony added, now the U.S. Federal Reserve is finally fighting inflation, which is pushing up interest rates and increasing financial costs. Rates on all kinds of consumer debt are rising. Mortgage interest rates have doubled since Joe Biden took office, greatly increasing Americans' monthly payments. Concerns about persistent inflation were renewed recently when U.S. Federal Reserve data showed consumer prices had increased 8.3% in August compared to the same month 1 year earlier, a figure that was worse than what economists had been expecting. The British newspaper The Guardian explains more about the same issue. US Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell warned recently that there would be pain ahead as the US central bank struggles to contain a surge in inflation unseen in the past 40 years. The US Federal Reserve announced another sharp rise in interest rates on Wednesday afternoon, 21st of September, after the conclusion of its meeting. It also updated its economic forecast for the U.S. economy. Economists said the Fed raised its benchmark interest rate by 0.75 percentage points, the third such rise in a row, and plans to raise interest rates again in the coming months. The interest hike comes as central banks around the world are increasing rates to tackle a soaring cost of living crisis. Last year, the U.S. Federal Reserve dismissed inflation as a transitory issue, triggered by the pandemic and supply chain issues. But consumer prices have remained stubbornly high and have remained so despite a change in the US Federal Reserve's view and its aggressive interest rate rises. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced recently that prices were 8.3% higher last month compared with August of last year. The US Federal Reserve's target rate for inflation is 2% annually. That news has led some to speculate that the US Federal Reserve could increase interest rates by a full percentage point, a drastic move for an institution that usually moves interest rates cautiously up and down by a quarter of a percentage point. The sharp rise in the interest rates are aimed at slowing the economy and bringing down prices. Higher interest rates have fed through to the housing market, where rates for a 30-year mortgage have now passed the 6% mark for the first time in the past 14 years. Until recently, Jerome Powell had suggested a soft landing was possible for the US economy, in which rising interest rates would bring down prices without causing a severe financial downturn. But at the annual meeting of the central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, last month, Jerome Powell acknowledged that economic distress was a price the US Federal Reserve was willing to pay to control inflation. He said, "While higher interest rates, slower growth, and softer labor market conditions will bring down inflation, they will also bring some pain to American households and businesses. These are the unfortunate costs of reducing inflation, but a failure to restore price stability would mean far greater pain." Moreover, The Hill reported U.S. markets are bottoming out as they process the latest interest rate hikes from the U.S. Federal Reserve in its battle to fight high inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 500 points to hit 29,590 at market close on Friday, 24th of September, its lowest point in nearly 2 years. Since the U.S. Federal Reserve started raising interest rates in March, the index has lost more than 13% of its value and is down more than 19% on the year. Other indices have followed suit. The Standard & Poor's 500 fell 65 points to close at 3,693 on Friday, down more than 15% since last March and almost 23% on the year. The technology-heavy Nasdaq index dropped nearly 200 points, or 1.8%, to close at 10,867, down almost 20% since last March. Interest rates have also increased to 3.25 percentage points since the US Federal Reserve started raising them from 0% last March. This has had the effect of making many goods and services more expensive and driving down demand to bring down inflation. Meanwhile, an opinion poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows the vast majority of the American public are dissatisfied with the state of the economy. According to the findings, around 29% of U.S. adults say the economy is in good shape, and 71% say it is doing poorly. The pollsters also revealed that only 27% of the American public are content with the economic and political course taken by the administration of President Joe Biden, while 72% say things are going in the wrong direction. Commenting on the survey results, the researchers noted, "Concerns about President Joe Biden's handling of the economy persist. Only 38% of the American public approve of Biden's economic leadership, while 53% disapprove of the way he has dealt with raging inflation. According to the opinion poll, the vast majority of the American public are concerned about domestic problems rather than foreign policy issues. The top five concerns are the rate of inflation, which jumped to 8.3% in the month of August, the state of the economy, the state of jobs, gun control, abortion, and soaring gasoline prices.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. A prayerful community means one which in its daily life distances itself from the leaders of corruption, those upon whom is Allah's wrath, مَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ And those who follow corruption, those who are astray, ضَالِّينَ The Qur'an, Surah 1, verse 7. This is what prayer means. Another of the meanings of to maintain the prayer could be to create a society like this. Then the Qur'an says, And spend out of what we have provided them. What is the next mark of the faithful? That they give to others out of the provision we have given them. What does spending, infaq, mean? You will recall I discussed this in the previous lecture. Infaq means to fill a gap or to meet a need. Therefore, it only refers to those kinds of spending which fill gaps or meet needs. They say the meaning of infaq is this. Just as if the wall of this mosque is already painted, but you come and spend money having it painted again. This is not infaq. Why? Because there was no need to do this. It was already painted. Or even if it was not painted, there was no need to do so. If you come and paint the earth around the Imam Hassan Mosque and say, we spent our wealth on the Imam Hassan Mosque. We took several crates of paint to the mosque and used them there. What have you actually done? You've painted some clods of earth and some dust. Yes, you've spent some money, but this is not what Allah means by infaq.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Infaq means to spend for the sake of closing gaps that need to be filled in the fabric of society and fulfilling actual needs, not just spending for the sake of spending. What does and spend out of what we have provided them mean? It means that true believers are those who give out of whatever Allah has given them. This doesn't just mean money. Does Allah say and spend out of the money we have provided them? No. Allah draws no distinction between the wealth He has given them, the life He has given them, the children He has given them, the dignity He has given them, the physical strength He has given them, the power of speech which He has given them, and the mind and ideas He has given them. So, what we have provided them includes all of the abilities and resources that Allah has placed at their disposal. And what do the truly faithful do with the things Allah has provided them? They spend out of them. They do infaq. In other words, they spend it where it is needed, not haphazardly. This is one of the marks of the true believer.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A dark, cold winter awaits Britain with strikes and chaos in major city centres as the new Prime Minister Liz Truss is unable to rein in the economic crisis. Even experts have warned that Truss is about to collapse under the dead weights of the British economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Road, British Prime Minister Liz Truss's shoulders are too fragile to carry the weight of a sagging British economy. The pound sterling is sinking vis-à-vis the US dollar and may fall even lower against the greenback. Truss, however, is the architect of her own misfortune. Raw ambition blinded her to the reality that Britain is not only sick, but on its deathbed. Within a month of becoming Prime Minister and after a grueling leadership contest in which she scrapped past Rishi Sunak, the Indian origin wunderkind of finance, reality has caught up with her. Truss does not have the competence to turn the British economy around. Being a female does not give her any advantage either. Truss dumped her finance minister Kwasi Kwarteng on October 14th, even though he followed her advice on cutting taxes to revive the economy. She essentially shifted blame for her policy to the ousted finance minister. In his resignation letter, Kwarteng said Britain faces an incredibly difficult situation and following the status quo was not an option. As I have said many times in the past weeks, following the status quo was simply not an option, he wrote. For too long, this country has been dogged by low growth rates and high taxation. That must still change if this country is to succeed. While Britain has been sliding into economic oblivion, it has been hastened by the sanctions imposed on Russia. Two of Britain's leading newspapers coming from the right and left, the Sunday Telegraph and the Guardian, gave similar prognosis for what ails Britain. Sanctions against Russia have led to rising prices, especially fuel price. Soon after the crisis in Eastern Europe on February 24th, and the West imposed sanctions on Russia, the Guardian wrote, the shock waves from the Russia-Ukraine crisis will cut UK living standards by £2,500 per household, lead to more persistent inflationary pressure, and slow the economy to a standstill next year, economists fear. Market confidence has crashed, and with the pound sterling in free fall, the Bank of England has had to intervene to raise interest rates faster than planned. This has caused a surge in mortgage rates, causing more pain for ordinary people. The British economy is held hostage to the interest of international bankers and investment managers. They insist on their interest being protected. They do not care what happens to the people. Most people's standard of living has fallen drastically. It has been underway for decades, but recent developments have hastened the fall. There is talk of a palace coup to replace Truss with Rishi Sunak. Will he be able to rescue Britain's economy? It seems highly unlikely. There are deep structural problems in the British economy. Discontent is bound to spill over into the streets and may even lead to violence. A dark, cold winter awaits Britain, as indeed in much of Europe, that will be punctuated by strikes and chaos in major urban centres. Welcome to Britain's status as a third world country. This is the price of following Uncle Sam, who is prepared to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. The price for this folly has to be paid by the Europeans while the US sits safely across the pond. According to the website of Euractiv, UK Prime Minister Liz Truss's month-old government is on the brink of collapse after she engineered another humiliating U-turn on planned tax cuts and sacked her finance minister, who was responsible for the proposals. On Friday, October 14th, Truss sacked Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng himself only in post for 38 days, and his deputy Chris Philip was also moved out of the Treasury. Former Health and Foreign Affairs Minister Jeremy Hunt, who served in former Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron and Theresa May's administrations, takes over the Treasury portfolio. You have asked me to stand aside as Chancellor, and I have accepted, said Kwarteng in a letter posted on Twitter. Kwarteng had been in Washington until last night at the International Monetary Fund Summit. However, the crisis leaves the UK's Prime Minister, who took over from Boris Johnson less than 6 weeks ago, under pressure from her Conservative Party. Senior figures are already drawing up plans to replace her in 10 Downing Street. 2 weeks ago, Kwarteng announced a mini-budget with plans to cut income tax across the board to stimulate the UK economy and keep it out of recession. However, the £45 billion giveaway, which followed the announcement of a programme of over £100 billion of state subsidies to help businesses and consumers pay sharply rising heating bills, was not accompanied by any economic forecast or plans to cut public spending, prompting a market run on the pound and UK government bonds. Truss has since ruled out any public spending cuts. Earlier this week, interest rates on 10-year UK government bonds reached 4.6%, having been below 2% for over a decade until the start of 2022. Analysts also expect the pound to fall to parity with the US dollar before the end of the year. In a press statement, the embattled Prime Minister abandoned plans to cut corporation tax from 25% to 19%. Last week, her plan to cut the top 45% income tax rate was also scrapped, following criticism from the International Monetary Fund, which urged Truss government to rebalance its fiscal plans to help the UK's poorest. The IMF has warned that the UK economy will grow by 0.3% next year against a backdrop of interest rates of between 5% and 6% and inflation at 9%. The latest political crisis in London does, however, serve as a cautionary tale to EU governments as treasuries across the bloc draw up their own plans to support individuals and businesses during the cost of living crisis, which Russia-Ukraine crisis has exacerbated. Last week, Germany's plan for a 200 billion euros aid package for its businesses and households met with an angry reaction from ministers from France, Italy and Spain, who warned that a series of national approaches would risk the fragmentation of the eurozone and increase the gap between rich and poor EU states.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen on March 2015, attacks on education centers have severely disrupted access to education. A recent UN report says over 2,900 schools have been destroyed, partially damaged, or used for non-educational purposes. Even though the world body did not mention the cause of the destructions in its report, most of the schools were hit by the Saudi aerial attacks.
Since the beginning of the war against our country, the Saudi-led coalition has been seeking to target the educational system because the enemy realizes the importance of education and its role in the society. So the coalition cut the salaries of employees, including teachers, which negatively affected the country's education. Due to the war, we were only able to print a very small percentage of the textbooks, and the poor living conditions forced many children to leave education and enter the labor market to support their families.
For its part, the International Committee of the Red Cross has urged the international community to save the education system in the country. It says there are over 2 million children out of school and over 8 million students need support to access education.
Over 2 million children don't have access to proper education in Yemen, and one out of four of all primary and secondary schools have been damaged or have been used for purposes other than what they're intended for. This is exacerbated by internally displaced people using some schools as shelters as they are forced to flee from their homes to escape the ongoing conflict. Of course, education will have long-lasting effects and ramifications that will indeed impact the Yemeni people for generations to come.
Structured learning has been further hindered as 172,000 teachers have been irregularly paid since 2016, while some have not been paid at all. Sadly, some teachers could not even cover the transportation costs as they are working voluntarily. Despite all the challenges, education remains the safety net for future generations. Therefore, Yemenis say they will keep pushing their children to schools, hoping to build a generation that will reconstruct the country after the Saudi-led war. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
Following weeks of unrest between Muslims and Hindus in the English Midlands city of Leicester, the local mayor has ordered an inquiry to get to the bottom of what's behind the rise in local tensions. Following the inquiry's launch, Leicester City Mayor Peter Salisbury met with local Muslim community activists on October the 11th, who expressed fears that the violence was largely the result of the arrival of an Indian Hindu supremacist political ideology known as Hindutva on British shores.
Lots of tough questions. You'd expect that. I mean, it's quite right that people, you know, are concerned about what happened, concerned about what it means, concerned about the ideology that lies behind it.
A Press TV investigation into the unrest found that a number of local Muslim residents had been hospitalised this year following attacks allegedly carried out by Islamophobic Hindu gangs, likely inspired by India's Hindutva ideology. Muslim activists informed Press TV that locals felt the police had failed to protect their community, leading to a fight back.
However, it isn't just Muslims who fear the arrival of Hindutva. British Sikhs are also well acquainted with the supremacist ideology, which preaches total intolerance of all of India's religious minorities.
The Hindutva is a fascist ideology that seeks the racial, social, religious purity of India and unification of India as an embodiment of Hinduism. So one nation, one language, and now with Modi, one market, where the Hindu is the human, the Hindu is the subject that is protected, and every other minoritized community is a threat, a potential threat to the integrity of India. It's a mythical project.
Hindu organisations in Britain have condemned the violence, but none seem to have acknowledged the accusations of Hindutva-inspired hate as a cause to the troubles. Muslim and Sikh onlookers hope that the inquiry will put the Hindutva ideology firmly under the spotlight. Robert Carter, London.
Washington is poised to spearhead yet another military intervention in protest-racked Haiti and will even propose a non-United Nations mission to do so. Anti-government protesters have become routinely labeled gang members in the Western mainstream media. However, many say that such a negative characterization aims to smooth Western public opinion for the use of force in Haiti yet again.
Even calling them gangs in some ways might be misleading. Some of these groups are political organizations, and the state is so weak because state institutions have been eroded by neoliberal policies, by corruption, by neocolonial policies, that these forces that are leading these protests could potentially have the power to overthrow this U.S. puppet government.
Haitian instability escalated following the 2021 assassination of President Jovenel Moïse by Colombian mercenaries. Western mainstream media have reported that several of the assassins worked alongside U.S. intelligence groups. Haitian media accuses Washington of hiding evidence to keep its role in the murder a mystery.
Who replaced him? A U.S. puppet named Ariel Henry, who's the current president. Ariel Henry has no democratic mandate, and he has a long history of serving U.S. imperial interests in Haiti. In fact, he got his political start in being involved in the coup backed by the U.S. that ousted the progressive, popular president, Aristide, who was the first ever democratically elected president of Haiti.
Haitian civil society groups have emphatically rejected the prime minister's call for foreign intervention. There is also widespread denunciation for the West, which continues to back the government despite its decision to indefinitely postpone elections and a constitutional referendum. Many protesters have called upon Beijing and Moscow to use their UN Security Council veto to reject an official United Nations mission. In 2010, UN peacekeepers caused an outbreak of cholera which killed 10,000 Haitians and infected nearly 1 million, with sexual assault scandals commonplace. For over two centuries, Haitian sovereignty